I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. This time last year, we were beginning to realize how destructive Superstorm Sandy was going to be as it moved across New Jersey. We are all familiar now with the photos of flattened buildings, flooded towns and neighborhoods, boardwalks and docks ripped apart, the roller coaster at Seaside Heights in the ocean, and a redrawn coastline. While some New Jersey towns and residents were able to rebuild within the last year, many others are struggling to get financing for their homes and businesses. Some have given up altogether. The federal government approved $60 billion for reconstruction projects. Today on the show, lessons learned and not learned from Superstorm Sandy. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Our guest, Justin Osiello, is a lifelong resident of South Seaside Park, has been a go-to source of information for New Jersey residents through Jersey Shore Hurricane News, a two-way online news outlet that he founded and runs. He also writes the Down the Shore blog for WHYY's NewsWorks website. He is a surfer, an urban planner, a journalist, and a traveler, and traveled all the way to Philadelphia to join us this morning here in our Philadelphia studios. And Justin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What were you doing a year ago today?
You know, it's funny, bits and pieces of those days surrounding Hurricane Sandy are still, they're still in my mind. Year ago today, I was in front of my computer. I was monitoring. There was flooding down in Cape May County as the storm was approaching. A lot of people were, there was a real sense of panic. People didn't know what was going to occur. Governor Christie was having press conferences right now, telling people just to get out.
Right, to leave the state.
Leave, just get out of the Barrier Islands, get out of the low-lying areas. And really, I was monitoring JSHN, reporting in real time as everything was occurring, and really being there for people. A lot of people had questions. A lot of people were concerned. What do I do? And me, I'm the guy. I was inland at my parents' house. I had evacuated late that night, the night before, around midnight. My house was all packed up. I thought I was going to lose my house. And I was in Command Central in my parents' dining room.
In your jammies?
In my jammies. and I was, actively reporting.
And the idea, what's, I think, unique about your site is that it uses crowdsourcing, that you are sort of sharing information, sending out questions to people, getting answers, vetting some of the information.
Sure.
And I guess trying to do what when you call 911 or emergency services do, doing that in your own kind of way.
Sure. And that's what makes social media so powerful, especially in light of the fact when you lose your power. If you have a car, you can charge it in your car. If you have a generator, you can charge the phone there as well. And that's how people were staying connected. So my role is I wasn't actually there in the quote-unquote danger zone, but because of the ubiquity of Facebook and, JSHN exploded in contributors. Now, I call people who like the page a contributor because
right.
I see them as a – like any other media outlet. There's someone on the ground. They're providing information. But the way – it's not this kind of – freewheeling place where social media gets criticized sometimes because people say, well, that's where rumors spread.
Right.
And that's how false reports get out there and cause public panic. Well, I run it differently. It is a page on Facebook, yes. But when that information is posted, right, that information is not seen by everyone unless it's been vetted, verified, and the standard practices of journalism by me.
Which is to check on the information or make an extra phone call, that kind of thing.
Check on the information, and I had started it in the days before Irene.
Right.
After Irene, I was like, what am I going to do with it now? But I had years of I had been writing about new media, blogging about it for years, and actively involved in it on Twitter. So I knew that it was an opportune time to create this real time news traffic and weather platform because people really want information as it's happening.
Well, especially during a hurricane.
Yes.
And was Irene a kind of a dress rehearsal then for Sandy, for you?
It was. Irene obviously wasn't as bad at the shore as it was inland. A lot of rivers, heavy rain, flooding inland. But there was damage to the shore. And leading into Irene, a lot of people thought that the shore was going to get wiped out. Part of the problem leading up to Sandy – where some people were throwing the word hype a lot. They were throwing that out. I had been reporting on Sandy 7 days prior about the potential risk.
As you watch the storm come up the coast.
Watch the storm. National Hurricane Center, they were actively monitoring, and the models, the forecasting models did a great job. The Euro model did a great job pinning it down really days in advance. But the hype word was thrown around. People were saying, I'm not leaving. Irene was nothing. All the media does is hype, and you know what? I'm going to stay. And that was the challenge. In the days in the few days before Sandy, people started to realize, oh, this is going to be big.
And what do people want to know? I mean, early on, was it just, is my house okay, or what is that? What is that thing that is in my front yard, or I've lost my pet? I mean, I'm just wondering of all the kinds of queries and questions you might have had.
A lot of people, obviously most of the people that now we know had left the low-lying areas. There were a number of people who had to be rescued.
Yes, exactly.
But in the day after, it was a real, real fascinating thing. The night at the height of the storm surge, a lot of people were contacting me and saying, I need to be rescued. The water is coming into my house.
Wow.
And I'm like, I started to like almost panic myself, because now I'm realizing like people are using this for 911. And that's not the way it should be used. If you need help, I can help you with other things, but not rescue. Hey, call 911. I can't get through to 911.
Oh, jeez.
It's overloaded. So I had put up this reporting thread, and I said, if you're trapped, call 911. If you can't get through, write your name, your address, how many people, how many medical, if you have a medical condition. Now, New Jersey OEM was monitoring. And they
monitoring your site.
Yes, I had built a relationship with them after Sandy. They had me to the headquarters in West Trenton at the state police headquarters, and they wanted to know more about me and my intentions and everything. Mm-hmm. So they said, if it ever happens again, we're going to be there. So they were monitoring, and they would say, Mr. Smith, you're in Ortley Beach at this. We got you. We're radioing personnel. Mm-hmm. So the day after, everyone wanted to know what happened. And then the images started trickling in. I had the early, because people were on the ground, I had the earliest images of the Jetstar roller coaster. I had two friends, Tim Husar and Jan Humphreys, who stayed in Seaside. And they were documenting the day and the days after. And they were sending me all this unbelievable footage. Yeah. And they're my friends, but the first photo I saw the Jetstar, I questioned. I said,
is that really in the ocean?
Is that really in the ocean? It was more rhetorical. They're not photoshopping anything, but I couldn't believe it. Yes. Okay.
And that was really an iconic image, I think, of Superstorm Sandy.
Absolutely. The image, it was the roller coaster in the ocean and then just wood all over the beach. It was probably the most intense image that I saw. And then a few hours later, I got an image of someone standing on the Manalokin Bridge facing towards Manalokin. And, that's where the inlet had formed, and homes were just washed away.
And Manalokin got hit really hard.
Very hard. I saw this photo, and I had no idea that Manalokin had – and I obviously, my job is to doubt, because if I send something out there, not only will it, ruin my reputation, but that's irrelevant. It's about creating more panic. So – I contacted a few sources in BRIC who I had developed in the intervening time between Irene and Sandy, and I said, what happened in Manalokin? Huh. And they said, you don't want to know. I said, no, I do want to know, because I have some information. And they said, there's an inlet, and homes had been washed away. And I sent them the photo, and I said, is this an accurate photo? They said, I hate to say, but it is, right? Reported that, and it was a really interesting thing that had happened. Fake. Why are you doing this to us? Stop. This is photoshopped.
That was the initial response?
Response.
Some of the initial response.
This didn't happen. This didn't happen because there's no news coverage there. And then people would write, there's probably no news coverage there because the helicopters aren't flying and you can't access it because everything is flooded. And I was I didn't get into an argument with people, but I would let them know, this is real. Mm-hmm. It's been my sources have told me this is true. It was that sense of, this can't be happening. This sense of, this is horrible.
I wonder, too, because I'm assuming at some point you went back home and you probably went to the places that you had been reporting on.
Yes.
And that your people had been reporting on. And I wonder what that was like for you to sort of maybe get a sense of in real life, not a photo, not something on social media, but something out there in real life.
It was very hard for me. As a reporter, it's your role to stay objective, not to interject your personal feelings. That's just the classic role as a journalist. When I got back there, about 10 days later, and went to my house. The house was fine.
Yeah.
I live right off the beachfront. I can literally throw a baseball into the beach, and the dunes had held up. My cousin did a great job for about 10 years. He was a shepherd of the dunes, and he made sure that they were, he kept on building up and protecting, and I give him a lot of credit for that.
And it worked, I guess.
And it worked. I mean, we lost about a third of our dune system. That's it. But going back, and my town, I live in South Seaside Park in a barrier island, and I live just south of Seaside Heights in Ortley Beach. And the bay came up and wrecked a lot of my friends' homes. Mm. So I helped them with gutting and all that. And it was just it was traumatizing. I'll be honest with you. It was to see my town, my area in shambles and to see it in real life and not just through the eyes of JSHA contributors was hard. It was hard. But that also brought a sense of, stick with this. Keep on focusing on this recovery. Keep on reporting the Sandy Beat and being there for the people because we need this. We need help.
And I wonder today, a year later, and even over the last couple of months as reconstruction has been in the news, is that what your contributors are writing about or perhaps expressing their frustration with?
Yes. It's been, after Sandy, it was a in the days and weeks after Sandy, it was a huge, effort to really get people the help they needed, humanitarian relief, and keeping people connected. As simple as even the days after, where can we find crowdsourcing? Where can we find gas, water, supplies? All this continued when December came, when the holidays came. It became really hard on a lot of people because the reality had set in, and they were, Christmas gifts. Simple as that. I just want to give my kids a sense of normalcy. At the start of the new year, people were then really focusing on what are the next steps? Where do we go from here? What help is available? And I was doing a lot of reporting on that, and really giving people information. And also people crowdsourcing once in a while. How do you feel about the ongoing recovery? And it's been real. It's been a task, but people have appreciated hearing what their community has been experiencing.
Let me pick up on that. That's Justin Osiello, founder of Jersey Shore Hurricane News, and became a go-to site source for information about Superstorm Sandy. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times as we mark the one-year anniversary, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 about lessons learned or not learned. And we have a second guest waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
At a time when trusted news and analysis is critical to understanding our complex world, your donations to WHYY during our membership campaign is the best reason why we're bullish about the future of public media. This is Bill Morazzo, President. Having a growing number of WHYY members makes it possible to have the financial strength to give you the news you expect from us every day and to grow those services to meet your needs for tomorrow. Thank you.
I'm George Takei. In 1938, families gathered in front of the radio at night.
Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds.
The War of the Worlds is the most famous radio broadcast of all time.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
And we're bringing it back for its 75th birthday.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are, like many people today, looking back on Superstorm Sandy 1 year later. And again, Justin Osiello with us here in our Philadelphia studios, a founder of Jersey Shore Hurricane News. He also writes the Down the Shore blog at WHYY's NewsWorks site. And joining us now is Mary Ann Spodo. She's been covering the rebuilding of the Jersey Shore after Hurricane Sandy for the Newark Star-Ledger. And Mary Ann Spodo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Oh, you're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We especially want to hear from our Jersey listeners. And we're looking for answers to the questions about lessons learned or not learned from Superstorm Sandy. Marian, let me throw a couple of questions at you, and then Justin, I'll get you back in on the conversation. How much of the New Jersey shoreline has been rebuilt so far? Is there any way to assess that, Marian?
It's difficult to say. The governor said this morning that he believes we're halfway there, that he thought it would take 18 to 24 months to rebuild, and he said this morning that he thinks we're halfway there.
And my understanding is that the damage was estimated to be something like $37 billion?
Yeah, that was public, that was public damage in some of the private residences, but as we go on, you know, people are expecting to find more damage and more costs related to that. You know, there's a lot of things that will be found out after the fact. People estimated how much of their homes were damaged, but then once you get into the rebuilding process, they'll find that even more damage. And the same thing with public property and the infrastructure.
Is there a part of New Jersey that seems to have gotten back on its feet faster than other parts of New Jersey?
There are pockets. Most, I would say, of the coastline is doing pretty well, but there are pockets that are still, you know, almost like day one. Seabright, we're talking about Manaloking, parts of Bay Head, those areas. There's areas like Munaki and Little Ferry that, they had a lot of the flooding, and they still have some infrastructure problems, but for the most part, they can do their day-to-day running around and things like that, but they still have rebuilding to do there as well.
Indeed. Pretty well. Is that how you see it, Josh? Is that how your contributors see it?
Well, contributors have been, you know, varied in the response. Last night, I had crowdsourced a question, what's your assessment and the ongoing recovery. The vast majority of the people now, you don't know if this is just the people that are just very vocal chiming in, but the vast majority of the people who responded to that were just saying, I'm just totally frustrated. I don't know what to do now. A lot of people are expressing frustration over the fact that these programs are so complicated. And then one lady said that, I went through the whole process and they changed the rules on me, and now I'm back to square one. You know, people are frustrated, but, you know, some people are back. There's a lot of frustration of second homeowners. Second homeowners don't qualify for FEMA assistance, and that's been a source of angst for many people. But, you know, homes are, in my community, in the Seaside area, you know, you're seeing a lot of homes go up on pilings. There's a lot of frustration on the government help for, say, the boardwalk, especially after the fire. People continue to say that money should be going towards the people. And then other people respond to that saying, well, without the boardwalk, there's no tourism. So 1 year, it's a tale of really two shores in many respects.
Well, Marian, let me go back to you because I know the Governor Christie has also been complaining. And it seems that some of this reconstruction money and perhaps even some of the red tape for that money is tied to Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans and some of the problems that happened in response to that hurricane.
Oh, yes. That basically in Hurricane Katrina, as soon as homeowners proved the amount of damages they had. Basically, the federal government cut them a check to do their repairs. Well, not all of the repairs got done. People would use that money for anything else, go take trips, do whatever they wanted with that. And then all these areas that were devastated by Katrina are still left in ruins because of that. Now, so in response to that, the federal government has put in a lot of controls, and which some residents, a lot of residents, and even the state government has said are becoming too onerous on people. It's a multi-step program. In the biggest program that the state has is the REM program, and because that's grants of up to $150,000 for homeowners, primary homeowners, who have that gap between how much it will take to rebuild their house and how much their insurance companies are actually giving them. And there, these are multi-steps in there, including environmental reviews and historical reviews that they have to do, make sure when they, you know, when they're doing any of the work, they don't disturb anything right. environmentally or historically. And those are taking a long time. Mm-hmm. And yesterday when Secretary Sean Donovan was in New Jersey, we had asked him if they plan to ease these. And he said, well, we'll think about, we're always looking to streamline this, but he didn't make it sound as if the environmental and historical reviews were on the table for discussion on taking them off.
And we should say that REM stands for Reconstruction, Rehabilitation, Elevation, and Mitigation Program. And it sounds like, Marian, so the money comes from the feds, but it's sort of managed by the state or operated by the state?
Right. It's the Community Development Block Grants money from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and it flows to the states. Each state has to submit a plan to HUD on how they would spend the money, and HUD has to review that, and then they'll approve it or have them make tweaks, and then they'll release the money. New Jersey got its first round in the spring of $1.8 billion. $600 million of that went to the REM program. And now, just yesterday, Secretary Donovan was in New Jersey to announce another round of that CDBG funding of $1.4 billion to New Jersey.
You said, Justin, when we were talking, so you're hearing from some of your contributors as well about this particular program,
yes.
The REM program.
Yes, there's a lot of people have expressed a tremendous amount of frustration about the REM program. Some people say, well, I understand it's the government. I understand there's red tape. It takes time. But after the storm, a lot of people bring up the fact they said, you know, Governor Christie said he's going to expedite everything and everything's going to flow quickly. And then they bring up the fact that in January, when the whole funding crisis for Superstorm Sandy, the whole package, people said, you know, well, Governor Christie was there and he was laying blame on the federal government, saying that they're not coming back for us. Now people are saying a year after, what's going on now? Hmm. How come I want to move forward? I want to remain at the shore. That's really the intention here, to get people to stay at the shore. So again, it's just the amount of confusion has not lessened since the storm struck.
And Marianne, is the governor getting an earful from New Jersey residents?
He is, actually. In the beginning, he would get when he would tour the areas of the shore, he would get the sob stories of people just telling him what they lost, and he would sit there and tell them, we're working for you, we're going to help you. And at one point, he even told people, rebuild, we're going to, you know, we're going to get that federal money and you can get it back. And that's where some of the frustration came in, because originally that CDBG money would not reimburse people for work they had already done. Mm-hmm. And people were, as Justin said, were very frustrated because they said, hey, you told us to start and now we're stuck. So that's when HUD went back and they said, okay, we'll reimburse you. Now, because this program is taking a lot of time, and the state government says this is the amount of time it has to take with these steps that the federal government requires us to do, now when people see Governor Christie, they're a little more forceful in what they're saying to him, and they're saying, hey, you know, what's going on? there's a little more frustration that they're venting instead of sorrow and shock.
Absolutely.
Now,
let me reintroduce the two of you. That's Marianne Spoto. She's been covering the rebuilding of the New Jersey shore after Hurricane Sandy for the Newark Star-Ledger. Joining us by telephone, Justin Osiello here with us in our Philadelphia studio. Founder of Jersey Shore Hurricane News, he writes the Down the Shore blog for WHYY's newsworks.org. And we are looking back on Superstorm Sandy 1 year later. What are the lessons learned or not learned? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to, looks like Bo from Cape May County. Bo, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have you, Bo? No, we don't seem to have Bo. We will try to get him back or get someone back as well. I have a question for you, Justin, from Jose from Burlington. How does Justin deal with the barrage of information he gets? Does he find it easier to report with deep ties to the community versus others on the scene?
That's a great question. you know, the number one thing that people have asked me, just like you had just asked, is the fact that people say, how do you retain your composure? How do you stay objective and unbiased? How do you not interject your own feelings, even though a lot of your friends and my my uncle lost his house, like four blocks from my house.
Wow.
How do you keep a semblance of being a journalist? I don't know. To be honest,
you probably struggle with this too, Marianne.
It's hard. It's hard to live there and experience it, but you have a job to do. You have a role as a journalist to really inform people, and also provide a lot of context. So it's been a challenge, but it's been a task that I've been happy to take on.
And Marianne, has this felt like a personal story for you?
Where I live, luckily, I didn't have any damage to my house. I'm a little further inland, but seeing the people, it's hard to when people are crying to you, that's where it becomes difficult, and you want to be compassionate, but also you have to keep a little bit of a distance as a journalist. Mm-hmm. But you want to at least take their story down and try to see where you can direct them. To get help, but without stepping over that boundary.
Go ahead.
That's been the hardest part.
Sure.
Yeah, and the one thing, because I am based on social media and the Facebook. Everyone has Facebook. A lot of people have contacted me privately and have asked me for help, and especially right after Sandy. And it's been hard because I want to help everyone. But I can't. And there were people right after Sandy contacted me privately say, I'm embarrassed. I don't want to because I would always crowdsource. If you need help, respond. Some people would say, I didn't want to put it out there. So they would say, can you help me? And I'd be like, yeah, what do you need? And then I would crowdsource it on my private Facebook page and, would collect ShopRite cards, clothing or whatever. Because when you are a journalist, you have to publicly have that sense of being unbiased. But when people are coming to you literally crying, I was getting phone calls, people crying. I had to do something.
That's tough. Marianne, Justin was talking earlier about the dunes that actually did protect his house. And I know the dunes have become a very big issue in New Jersey and that a number of communities are starting to use eminent domain proceedings against homeowners who oppose dune construction. Does eminent domain sort of open the way for more and perhaps bigger dunes in New Jersey?
I would say bigger for some of the towns, but they would be uniform with ones that have already been built in New Jersey, again, using eminent domain and using the Army Corps projects. It definitely has opened the door, but I think what actually did open the door was Sandy, because in towns like Manaloking, where they had resisted dunes for a long time, they're like, they're pretty much all saying, yeah, give us those dunes. There are a few holdouts there, which is why they had to start to use eminent domain now. But it's many more people who are in support of getting the dunes there now. And Bayhead, they're having a little bit of, a little bit of a difficulty yet getting those. So, you know, it's a battle that's going to go on for a while yet.
Have there been, let me toss this to you, Marianne, but I'd like to hear from you, Justin, as well, which has to do with just health issues. And you're thinking of just the surge and what the surge can do to infrastructure and sewer lines and all of that. Have there been health issues related to that, Marianne?
Deborah Hospital has been out in the community and performing lung function tests. So far, we haven't heard that there is anything health-related in that way, but they still keep on testing. But out here, people are worried about that. I met with one couple who, you know, they showed me around their house, which is gutted and it's moldy in there, but they're like, let's get out of here. I don't want to hang in there or anything. Mm-hmm. They told us it's not safe to stay in there. So there's always that concern with people. And I spoke with another woman who had been living, an elderly woman, who had been living in her house, which was growing mold, and then she says she got sick from that, some respiratory problems, and that's when she finally decided to leave. So there are little stories there.
Sure.
It's not a major issue yet.
How about for you, Justin? Have you been hearing from folks about that?
You know, from public health experts, I really have not heard anything about a ongoing problem. But I know in the days after Sandy, a lot of, you know, professionals were going around telling people, wear a mask, you know, wear a respirator, wear protective gear. A lot of people were saying, no, I'm going in. I need to gut my house immediately, and I don't have time to do the, you know, protective aspects. But I have heard from people on JSHN. There are people who say their, you know, first floor was destroyed, and they're living on the second floor. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, yeah, there's mold, but what am I going to do? Need a place to live. I have a roof over my head. I'm living on the second floor. But, you know, it's really interesting. The public health has really not been a major issue that people have been talking about. And, you know, we don't know what the future is going to hold. So it is a concern, but that really has, in my experience from speaking with people, that really has been in the back burner in many ways.
Mary, we have to say goodbye to you in about a minute. We have a guest who's going to be joining us talking about perhaps it's time to retreat from the beach. Is that an issue that has come up in your reporting in New Jersey? And is there, I mean, this is a very personal issue, obviously, but is that an option, do you think, for some people?
It has come up. It is an option for some. Part of the programs, some of the programs that are being offered to the residents are buyouts. But the problem with that is the governor has said he wants to do buyouts of entire neighborhoods. And at the Jersey Shore, you're just not going to get an entire neighborhood who wants to leave. They love the shore. Some of them, their houses weren't damaged, so they don't have to leave. So there's that question, yeah, should we retreat? But even if we try to, people aren't going to. There's just that demand for the property there.
Well, on that note, Marianne Spoto, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She covers has been covering the rebuilding of the Jersey Shore after Hurricane Sandy for the Newark Star-Ledger. Justin Osiello, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And he's the founder of Jersey Shore Hurricane News, and he also writes the Down the Shore blog at WHYY's NewsWorks site. We have Orrin Pilkey waiting in the wings, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by Pennsylvania College of Health Sciences. Applications are being accepted for an online RN to BSN program beginning this fall. More information online at pacollege.edu.
Standing on the corner.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Lou Reed, who died Sunday at 71. We'll talk with Bill Bentley, who was Reed's longtime friend, worked as his publicist, and wrote liner notes to some of his recordings. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
You know, those were different times.
Senator Bernie Sanders says, "I told you so," regarding unbridled U.S. electronic spying.
How are we going to have the kind of cooperation that we need when there is massive mistrust now against the United States for this type of spying?
Europe not amused by new revelations of NSA spying. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Many residents in our region, especially along the Jersey Shore, are still recovering from Superstorm Sandy. I'm Dave Heller. Join us Tuesday at 6 for a special Newsworks Tonight broadcast as our region marks the first year anniversary of the storm.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we are doing what many people are doing today, which is looking back on Superstorm Sandy 1 year later. And joining us now is Orrin Pilkey. He's the James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences in the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. He's a marine and coastal geologist, and he specializes in the study of barrier islands and the impact of humans on our shorelines. And Orrin Pilkey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. I'm pleased to be here.
I know you visited New Jersey earlier this year. I guess it was probably late winter, early spring, a few months after Sandy caused so much damage. What did you see as you assessed what happened to New Jersey?
Well, I guess my first hurricane came in 1969, so to speak, when I went down to Mississippi to rescue my parents' house. And so I've seen a lot of hurricane damage, but what really impressed me along the Jersey Shore was the extreme hazard that they face there. So many of the islands have lost all of their dunes. They're perfectly flat at a very low elevation. All the roads go straight from the sea to the sound or bay behind it. And so everything is set up for a really, really very, very exciting, shall we say, response to sea level rise.
Well, and we call this Superstorm Sandy. I don't even actually know what that means. I mean, we know it was a big storm, in many ways a big storm, because of the water surge. Is that a correct way to describe Sandy as a superstorm?
Well, I think it's a superstorm primarily in the amount of damage that it did, because it struck such a very heavily developed area. You know, a storm, for example, that would strike the Outer Banks of North Carolina would affect far fewer people, far fewer buildings. Its wind velocity, storm surges were relatively small compared to some of the hurricanes in the southern U.S., but because it hit so many buildings in such a high population, so closely spaced buildings, it was a superstorm in that sense.
It's been a pretty quiet fall so far this year, but do you think Superstorm Sandy is the sort of beginning of stronger, more devastating storms?
You know, nobody knows for sure, but I think we ought to assume that. All indications are that it should be, that there should be more storms and more powerful storms, because as the oceans warm, the hurricanes are going to pick up warmth or higher temperatures from the water, and therefore will become more powerful storms. That's the most dangerous part of it. The storms that strike the northeast part of the U.S. occur at longer intervals than those that strike the southern and southeastern U.S. But when the ones that strike here tend to be superstorms, because there's so much population, so many buildings, and so forth.
Well, in fact, I was reading, it's probably some of things that you have written, is something like 30% of the country lives near a coastline.
Yeah, that's true, something like that. And the percentage of our population that lives near the coast is increasing. Of course, everybody lives near the coast is not living at low elevations. But a good portion of us are, those who are moving to the coast. And a particular attraction seemed to be the barrier islands. And there in New Jersey and New York, there is the most hazardous places, are the barrier islands, the most dangerous place to live, in my view. And I think we need to begin a retreat from the shoreline, a managed retreat, a thoughtful retreat.
I want to pick up on that about what a managed thoughtful retreat is, but help us understand sea level rise. I know it is measurable, and I know there's some pretty, I would say, frankly, scary predictions for the next 100 years. What should we know about sea level rise?
Well, sea level rise is caused primarily by the heating of the ocean, which causes it to expand. Currently, that's the most important cause of sea level rise. But we anticipate in this century that the melting of the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica will become more important. Overall, measuring both with tide gauges and with satellites, it's very clear that the seas are rising. And you know what's really important, what a lot of people don't understand, is that when the sea is rising over a very flat area, like along the coastal plains, starting in New Jersey and going south, the amount of shoreline retreat or shoreline erosion is going to be much larger. So let's say if sea level rises 1 foot, the amount of retreat of the shoreline is going to be much larger than 1 foot. It can be several times that, maybe several hundred times that. So it's a tiny sea level rise is not to be ignored. And of course, we think, well, the estimates of sea level rise by the year 2100 range from 1.5 feet to 5 feet, and the consensus probably is around 3 feet. 3 feet is a really, really large sea level rise. And another ramification of this is the nourishment of beaches, or the building of dunes on New Jersey shoreline, for example. Nourishment of the beaches in New York isn't going to work at a 3-foot rise in sea level. The sand is going to disappear very quickly. And so we need to think about these things. We need to be planning for this. And I must say that I think I've seen more recognition of the sea level rise and global change in this hurricane than I've ever seen before, and that's very good. I don't think we're doing anywhere near as much as we could in terms of recognition of the future, but at least compared to what it was 30, 40 years ago, we are no longer, we're really recognizing the problem, and we're no longer looking at a hurricane as a time to be patriotic and to show that we're tough Americans and so forth. We're getting beyond that.
But what's interesting is one of the maybe short-term lessons in New Jersey is that the towns that had dunes were better protected from Superstorm Sandy, and now there are efforts to rebuild the dunes along the shoreline in New Jersey. Are you saying that's just a lost cause over time?
Of course it's a lost cause over time. First of all, you'll never rebuild them all at the same time, and those dunes are just like all dunes. They're temporary piles of sand that will be destroyed in future storms, so you'll have to replace them. But you're holding the shoreline still, and how desperately we need to have some panels of scientists and engineers and politicians and so forth to really stand back and say, what can we? We can't hold the shoreline still forever, and we're going to have a hard time just for another decade. And so, what are some imaginative approaches we can do? We could, for example, build dunes in the middle of the island, or we could take the roads. Is something I saw on so many New Jersey islands, that the roads go straight from the ocean back to the sound, and boy, that's just all the waves and all the storm surges just have their path is perfectly clear to destroy buildings all over the island. There are lots of other things we could do that are difficult, there's no question about it, and politically very difficult, engineering-wise not difficult at all.
We need
to do some real thinking about this.
Well, you talk about planned retreat, and you know, I'm sure it seems very un-American to use the word retreat. I'm kind of kidding there, but nonetheless, this notion of pulling back from the shore, and I'm sure individuals maybe can decide that for themselves. And Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, has sort of put the kibosh on the notion of whole communities retreating. But is that what we need to do, do you think?
Yes, you know, you have to. The whole community has to move back. If you still have a few buildings up there, up right next to the beach, we're going to continue to defend them. I mean, beachfront property owners tend to be important people, that is, wealthy, influential, and so forth, beyond certainly more than the average citizen, and they tend to be able to bring in the engineers. And if the whole community doesn't move back, then the situation is lost. You haven't changed anything. And I know that's difficult, that people are people, and they have a wide range of opinions and values. But if we don't do it as a group, if we don't all do it, then it's not going to work.
Well, let me give out that phone number again, and love to get your response to what Aaron Pilkey is talking about, which is a planned retreat from some of the coastline of New Jersey, since we're focusing in on New Jersey in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy 1 year later. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Aaron Pilkey, I was reading a lot today about wetlands and the role that wetlands play. And I wonder, if we sort of do coastal restoration and rebuild wetlands and marshes, would that help mitigate some of the potential harm from a storm?
I don't think so. Not as much as we're, you know, there was a lot of thinking back in down in the Mississippi Delta that rebuilding the marshes that have been destroyed so broadly and so widely, that would change the storm surge that came in. But I think now we're beginning to recognize that it's not going to have that much difference. There are a lot of good reasons for restoring the marshes, no question about that. But if you want to reduce storm surges and flooding from hurricanes, I don't think it's going to make that much difference. So, you know, one thing to mention that really impressed me when I went up the coast, went up the New Jersey shore, was the fact that along some islands, the streets were wet. And I thought, wow, well, this surely it's been a long time since the storm. Well, it turns out that on the back side of a lot of the islands, during spring tides, the high moon tides, there was flooding. Just level, you know, not more than a few inches maybe, but that's flooding that didn't occur 20, 30 years ago. And the same thing's happening in Norfolk, Virginia, Miami Beach, Florida, flooding that has not occurred in the past, which is a response, which is an indication of local sea level rise. And this is serious business, the sea level rise. And it's here. It's with us right now.
What about things like jetties and other, I guess, structures that we see going from beaches into the ocean? Does that in any way calm some of these storms?
Well, no, yeah, in some ways, the jetties, or as we call them elsewhere, groins, they do build up the beach in one location, but then they cause the loss of the beach in another direction on lateral. It causes loss of sand laterally. When you widen a beach because of a groin, you're trapping sand and widening the beach. That's good. A wide beach is a good thing to respond. That'll help respond to a storm causing the waves to break further offshore and things like that. But basically, though, groins tend to be a losing proposition. The only people who like them in New Jersey, I think, are the surfers, where they get the best breaks around the ends of groins or jetties.
Indeed,
but they're
do.
Basically a losing proposition. It really, a seawall, if you're looking purely at the stopping or impacting on waves and storm surges, a seawall is a better thing to build. But seawalls always destroy beaches in the long run unless you nourish them. So seawalls are a losing proposition as well.
Let me see what Barbara from Westchester has to say. Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to say that I completely agree with what your guest is saying about a planned retreat. And even though I don't have any involvement with the Jersey Shore as a homeowner, I have experienced a 30% increase in our homeowners insurance this year. And when I spoke to our broker and asked why and said, was this due to Superstorm Sandy, the response was, oh no, Sandy hasn't even been factored into insurance rates yet. This is from the previous year's destructive East Coast storm. So the truth of the matter is we all pay either directly through taxes for remediation or indirectly through raises in our insurance premiums for our household, because we're all part of this giant system.
Well, indeed, and that's how insurance works. Oren Pilkey, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think the general point she's making is that the question is, why should we, who didn't build right next to an eroding shoreline, why should we have to pay for that kind of for the damage caused? It wasn't very prudent to build right next to the shoreline. And there are and these people are the ones, in part, are responsible for our increasing taxes, and especially increasing insurance, especially flood insurance, federal flood insurance.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, and there was a motto that grew out of Superstorm Sandy in New Jersey, that we were stronger than the storm. What do you think of that motto?
Oh, I hate that. I really hate that. That's what I saw when I went down to rescue my parents at their, when they went through Hurricane Camille in 1969. I saw American flags in front of almost every house, and some in front of vacant lots where the house had been destroyed, and all kinds of patriotic slogans and things. And even then, even way back then, I could see this is crazy. I mean, this is nature. This is nature doing this to us. It's not a matter of patriotism or being very powerful and important. It's a matter of us recognizing nature and doing something about it, not just thumbing our nose at nature.
Well, Oren Pilkey, thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Hey, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
You're very welcome. He's Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University, a marine and coastal geologist specializing in the study of barrier islands and the impact of human beings on our shorelines, and his most recent book in 2011, The Rising Sea. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.